What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting, gathering evidence of radicalization in California. A federal investigator says he believes both suspects in last week's mass shooting in San Bernardino, California, were radicalized for some time, and there's evidence they pre-planned the attack. David Bowditch is assistant director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
As the investigation has progressed, we have learned that both subjects were radicalized and have been for quite some time. Now, how did that happen? The question we're trying to get at is how did that happen, and by whom, and where did that happen? And I will tell you right now, we don't know those answers at this point.
However, he says there is no evidence U.S.-born Syed Rizwan Farooq and his Pakistani wife were part of a broader overseas plot. They carried out the mass shooting at a gathering of local government workers, killing 14, wounding 21. They were both killed in a shootout with police. U.S. defense officials have confirmed senior al-Shabaab leader was killed last week in Somalia. U.S. Navy Captain Jeff Davis said Monday the December 2nd strike killed three, including Abdirahman Sondhir, also known as Ukash. Davis also confirmed a November 13 airstrike killed a senior Islamic State leader in Libya known as Abu Nabil. Meanwhile, an American who fought alongside al-Shabaab in Somalia has turned himself in to security forces. Abdimalik Jones was arrested in southern Somalia near the port of Barawi. He claims to have fled the militant group because of internal disagreements. It's believed there are divisions within the jihadist group or whether to pledge allegiance to the Islamic State or al-Qaeda. Tanzanian President John Magufuli has sacked several top transport ministry and port officials over allegations of corruption, including the disappearance of hundreds of shipping containers. This is VOA News. The UN has made its biggest ever humanitarian appeal to deal with a growing number of crises around the world. Stephen O'Brien is the UN humanitarian chief.
Human suffering has reached levels not seen since the Second World War. More than 125 million people will need humanitarian assistance to survive in 2016. Of those, we target the most vulnerable, 87.6 million people. We appeal with our partners for $20.1 billion to do so.
He says Syria, Iraq, South Sudan, and Yemen are the countries where needs are greatest. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden says $190 million in new U.S. aid to Ukraine will help that country implement reforms and fight corruption.
All Ukrainians, officials, business leaders, the business community, everyday citizens, they've got to work together to root out corruption that has held this country back for so long. Mr. President, you and I have discussed this before. The Ukrainian people cannot once again have their hopes dashed based on the cancer of corruption.
His comments came during a joint briefing with Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko. Mr. Biden said the U.S. also firmly stands with the people of Ukraine in the face of continued aggression by Russia and Moscow-backed separatists. Latvia's prime minister has handed in her resignation. Laimdot Staujuma said Monday she's stepping down after only 2 years in office because new ideas are needed. Her resignation follows infighting within her center-right ruling coalition. U.S. media reports say Iran has tested a new medium-range ballistic missile in defiance of two U.N. Security Council resolutions. U.S. officials speaking on the condition of anonymity told media outlets the test was held November 21st. They say the missile traveled within Iranian territory. Americans Monday marked the 74th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Thousands joined a dwindling number of survivors of the 1941 attack that signaled U.S. entry into the Second World War. Among the commemorative speakers, Rear Admiral John Fuller.
Today, at this ceremony, we demonstrate that the lives lost on December 7th and in World War II were not lost in vain. We show our deep appreciation. We know and we remember that those who sacrificed so much in World War II brought the world a greater freedom, more democracy, and a pathway to reconciliation and peace.
More than 2,400 U.S. service personnel were killed in that attack. The price of crude oil fell more than $2 Monday to its lowest level since early 2009, with Brent crude closing a bit above $40 a barrel. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Burkina Faso's September failed coup leader has been charged in the murder of Thomas Sankara.
My reaction is a good one, that because we are fighting always and always to get some justice, because Thomas Sankara is one of our presidents in Burkina Faso.
Basi Bassoma is the leader and chief negotiator for Burkina Faso's labor unions. China plans to build its first military base in Africa in Djibouti. Human rights groups say Kenyan police shootings killed hundreds since 2009. And the UN Secretary General urges a transformative agreement to avoid a climate catastrophe.
I say to you that your decisions can lay the foundation for a sustainable future, where both the people and planet can thrive.
That's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon speaking at the Climate Change Conference in Paris. No reconciliation in the PK-12 neighborhood of the Central African Republic. And Zimbabwe signs a debt rescheduling agreement. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The leader and chief negotiator for the Confederation of Labor Unions in Burkina Faso says the Burkinabe people are happy now that authorities have brought charges against General Gilbert Diendéré for the murder of the country's admired revolutionary leader, President Thomas Sankara. Sankara was assassinated in 1987 military coup led by Diendéré and Blaise Compaoré. Diendéré, a former Compaoré chief of staff, also led a failed coup in September this year against Burkina Faso's transitional government. Labor unions leader Basi Bassoma says the authorities must also charge former President Compaoré and investigate other African and world leaders who are believed to have had a role in Sankara's death.
My reaction is a good one, that because we are fighting always and always to get some justice, because Thomas Sankara is one of our presidents in Burkina Faso, who be killed by Blaise Compaoré and Diendéré and so on. So if in this moment we found now the road to find the killers, it is a good thing.
You said Thomas Sankara was killed by Blaise Compaoré. Now, do you think that Blaise Compaoré should also be charged?
Yes. We must let the justice do some work, but we know that there are Blaise Compaoré. But it is not only Blaise Compaoré. We know that many countries can be found in these problems. We know that many presidents don't want to see him be president in our country. Yadema of Togo, Félix Houphouët-Boigny in Côte d'Ivoire. We know also François Mitterrand in France, and so on.
The election is over, and the winner of the election used to be a prime minister in Blaise Compaoré's government. Do you think he might not want to bring charges?
The new president is Rokuma Christian Kabore, but we know it is the same system of Blaise Compaoré. We know that if we want justice in our country, it is not the things that the government will give simply. It is the result of fighting of the people. If we want justice, we must fight always to get justice. If no, it is not the new president who will come with justice for us. If we sit down and we don't do something for that, we will not go on the road of justice.
You were the chief negotiator and spokesperson for the Confederation of Labor Unions in Burkina Faso during the protests. Now that the election is over, are you satisfied with the outcome, and are you finished with protests now?
No, protestation is not finished. It is not finished because workers have many problems who haven't got solutions. We have a problem on justice. We have many problems on liberties, labor organization liberties and democratic liberties. There are many problems. There are many problems. So we call before elections each candidate to this election to present them our problems before elections. So if we have now a new president, we think that he know already our problems. So we will not lost time to wait. We are waiting for solutions for our problems.
Bazzy Bassoma is the leader and chief negotiator for Burkina Faso's labor unions. He was speaking with me from the capital, Ouagadougou. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon urged nations to make the compromises necessary to put the planet on a carbon-free path or risk a climate catastrophe. He spoke as negotiators to reach a climate change deal by Friday. As Lisa Bryant reports for VOA from Paris, a new draft agreement is expected on Wednesday.
With just 4 days left for climate negotiations, UN Secretary General Ban called on nations to heed what he called a rising global tide of demands to reach a transformative agreement.
I say to you that your decisions can lay the foundation for a sustainable future where both the people and planet can thrive. Your work here this week can help eradicate poverty, spark a clean energy revolution, provide jobs, opportunities, and hope for tomorrow, particularly for young people and succeeding generations. There can be no mistaking the peril before our eyes.
In remarks to ministers from nearly 200 nations and later to journalists, Ban mixed hope for success in talks outside Paris with dire warnings about what could happen to the planet and to future generations if that doesn't happen. On Saturday, negotiators reached a first draft of an agreement that's supposed to be concluded by Friday. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has joined foreign and environment ministers in giving a final push to the talks. France's Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius has created four working groups to tackle the biggest unresolved themes, including attacking differences between rich and poor nations and improving on national climate plans. The climate stakes are highest for some of the world's poorest and most vulnerable nations, like the tiny Pacific island of Tuvalu. They are pushing for going beyond the current goal of limiting global warming to no more than 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. Tuvalu's Prime Minister, Enele Sosone Sopoaga, says going beyond 1.5 degrees Celsius will mean the demise of his country and others like it. Together, current national plans limit global warming to almost double that temperature.
There is a big whale, as we say in the Pacific, in the lagoon. We must rise above this fear and address this big whale, or else we all perish.
There are plenty of other sticking points to reaching a deal, including financing for the poorest nations and ensuring countries not only stick to their carbon-cutting goals, but go further in the coming years than what they will promise in Paris. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
A Kenyan human rights group says police and security forces have been responsible for nearly 300 gun-related killings and dozens more injuries in the past 2 years, including cases of summary executions and stray bullets striking bystanders. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
28-year-old Jeremy Mutiso was sitting near his home in Mathare chatting with friends one Sunday evening in June 2011 when a demonstration started. Police arrived to break it up.
From where I was watching, I heard 4 bullets, gunshots, then the fourth one was so loud. Then I kind of got tensed, and when I was trying to run into our house, my hand couldn't move because I had pocketed my hands at the back. So when I tried to pull them up, only the upper part could move.
Those running behind him told him that he was short and bleeding. It took hours to get to the hospital, where he spent 2 weeks. From his hospital bed, Mutiso asked if his father followed up the case, and he says he was shocked by the answer.
We can't do that. He's afraid. We will not be able to win the case. Reason being, he's afraid the cops might fight back in terms of harassing us.
Mutiso moved to a safer neighbourhood. Kenya's independent medical legal unit, IMLU, says security forces were behind at least two-thirds of gun-related deaths in Kenya between 2009 and 2013, and the trend has continued. The IMLU, which specialises in cases of torture and abuse by the state, says it recorded 199 killings by police in 2014 and dozens more injuries. The IMLU says it had recorded 97 killings this year as of October. The advocacy group says the vast majority of victims since 2009 were shot in the back or in the head, something the IMLU says points to execution-style killings or situation in which security forces' lives were not under direct threat when they fired. Peter Kiama, the head of IMLU, says many cases go unreported, and for the few victims who speak out, justice is rare.
In 99% of the cases that we have handled in the last 5 years of people who have died from police bullets, whether they are suspects or victims of police stray bullets, the police have denied being involved, and therefore it has taken the family to follow up with the government. In the majority of the cases, the families just resign to fate.
Police spokesman Charles Owino says while people may get shot during operations, the number is exaggerated and police are not always to blame.
We must justify why we have shot at the criminal. But the criminal is not accountable to any action that they take. So for that reason, we have incidences where people have lost their lives through stray bullets. But it is not that large number, like 200 annually, as put by IMLU.
A government agency created in 2012, the Independent Policing Oversight Authority, has also raised concern about police shootings. In one recently concluded investigation, the agency recommended murder charges against a police constable in the shooting deaths of two university students in November 2014. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Today's Tuesday, December 8th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butty in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. We give a shout-out to listeners on our affiliate station, Radio Lake Victoria in Kisumu, Kenya. Daybreak Africa time, 16 and a half minutes past the hour. Last year, thousands of Muslims were evacuated from the besieged PK-12 neighborhood in the Central African Republic capital, Bangui. More than 18 months later, their houses have been taken over by Christians, some of whom have no intention of giving them up. Chris Stein reports from Bangui.
Minutes after thousands of Muslims were evacuated in a convoy of trucks, mobs stormed PK-12. They ripped roofs and doors off homes and businesses. Others dropped to their knees and shouted Allahu Akbar to mock the Muslims that had once called PK-12 home. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has called the two-year-old sectarian conflict in CAR ethno-religious cleansing. PK-12 is a stark example of what that means. It became one of the last Muslim safe havens in Bangui after the conflict started in 2013. After Muslims were evacuated, the local mosque was destroyed, and Christians like Gervais Takamba moved into the vacant houses. He says the house he lives in now is not for Muslims. It's for Christian Central Africans like him. Even if the Muslims were to come back, he could not accept having one living in that house again. Consulting researcher for Amnesty International, Jonathan Pedneau, says the question of property rights will have to be answered if Muslims are to return to their old neighborhoods.
That certainly is a major obstacle to their return, because once they are enabled to come back, what you'll have is obviously a lot of land conflicts, which will certainly just bring back more fuel to the fire that is still ongoing at the moment.
When the fighting broke out in December 2013, Mohamed Sarabjo fled from PK-12 to another Muslim neighborhood called PK-5. It's now the last Muslim neighborhood in the capital, but he has not forgotten about his old home. When it becomes safe to go back, Sarabjo says he'll go back to PK-12. He has the legal documents, and he'll use them to get his property back. CAR is far from a lasting peace. Killings occur sporadically in the capital. Last week, 8 people were killed in a refugee camp south of the second city, Bambari. Chris Stein for VOA News, Bangui.
China plans to build its first overseas military outpost in the East African nation of Djibouti, a move that analysts say is part of a broader global economic strategy and reflects deepening ties with Africa. VOA's Jill Craig has more from Nairobi, with additional reporting from Beijing by Shannon Vincent.
China says the naval base in Djibouti will be a logistics and supply center. It is China's first overseas military installation. The United States, France, and Japan also have bases in Djibouti. The small East African country is close to African hotspots like Somalia and the Sahel and sits on the Gulf of Aden, along a key global trade route linking the Red Sea to the Indian Ocean. Peking University Professor of International Relations Wang Dong says the facility will be instrumental in protecting Beijing's key shipping routes.
It's not really a military, quote-unquote, military base. It's more of access to supply, you know, because China has been conducting the counter-piracy missions in the Gulf of Aden for a couple of years, and there is a logistic need for resupply.
China deployed UN peacekeeping troops to South Sudan this year and has contributed ships to anti-piracy patrols in the Gulf of Aden since 2008. But the country's foreign policy has long been based on non-interference in other countries' internal affairs. Head of the Africa program at the London-based Chatham House, Alex Vines, says the Chinese are experimenting with this new base.
They still want to emphasize that China is different from other powers in Africa, so it's not like France that has military bases in various places, or the US that has a military base at Camp Lemonnier. So they're framing this as just a naval facility. In effect, though, that this is about Chinese experimentation longer term. How will African governments react?
Alexander Neal is a senior fellow at the Institute for Strategic Studies Asia office in Singapore. He says the Chinese are enlarging their footprint in Africa in other ways as well, a foreign trade and investment strategy known as One Belt, One Road. It refers to setting up land and maritime trade routes, a kind of modern-day version of the historical Silk Road.
So I think the big shift has been emulating more of what we've seen in the One Belt, One Road project, which is to shift towards bringing Chinese excess capacity into Africa to build infrastructure, to provide soft loans, interest-free loans, and to stimulate business ventures in Africa with Chinese partners, whereas China's approach was perhaps more extractive over the last decade.
Every 3 years, Beijing has doubled its financial support for Africa, from $5 billion in 2006 to $10 billion in 2009, and then to $20 billion in 2012. Now, China has tripled that number. President Xi Jinping was in South Africa last week, where he pledged $60 billion in loans and aid to Africa. That followed announcements of $156 million in emergency food aid for drought-afflicted nations, and a further $60 million for an African Union military rapid response force. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Zimbabwe and the International Fund for Agricultural Development, also known as IFAD, have signed a debt rescheduling agreement that will result in IFAD resuming financial support to Zimbabwe, initially providing $55 million under the country's smallholder irrigation privatization program next year. Erwin Chifera of VOA's Zimbabwe program reports from Harare.
IFAD Regional Director for East and Southern Africa, San Jata, who was in Harare to sign the deal, said the organization, which suspended projects in Zimbabwe over 23 million arrears, was re-engaging it in a new deal that has seen Zimbabwe pay 10% of the arrears and made an undertaking to pay the remainder over a five-year period. He said the program to be funded by IFAD will rehabilitate and develop new smallholder irrigation schemes covering 8,000 hectares and benefiting more than 20,000 households.
The government, we are expecting, and the beneficiaries to contribute about $5 million, and another co-financier still to be identified. We are working around that, another $10 million.
He said IFAD will provide more financial resources if Zimbabwe does not fall into arrears again. Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa said, due to climate change, government efforts to develop agriculture must focus on irrigation.
We have no choice. This is now out of necessity, and we should plow and deploy more resources in this sector. So the assistance that we are going to get, the resources that we are expecting to obtain from IFAD, will be a major shot in the arm of the agricultural sector in this country, especially irrigation development.
Deputy Agriculture and Mechanization Minister Padijanda said the agricultural sector continues to face many challenges, such as lack of adequate inputs and climate change. He said resources from IFAD should be used to address these issues and ensure food security, especially in rural areas.
The program will sustainably increase diversification of production, productivity and household incomes for smallholder farmers. This support is aligned to the food and nutrition cluster, the ZIM asset economic blueprint, and the 10-point plan for economic growth, whose fundamental pillar is the revitalization of the agriculture sector and the agro-processing value chain.
The IFAD program will have four components, namely rehabilitation and development of irrigation infrastructure, agricultural credit, institutional strengthening, and market access and business development. Government, in the meantime, is expected to establish a unit that would coordinate the implementation of the program. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with golf. Little-known Australian Mark Leishman was a convincing winner of the four-day Nedbank Golf Challenge in Sun City here in South Africa on Sunday. British reporter Nick Day asked him how he felt shortly after his landmark achievement.
Oh, man, it's awesome. Haven't won since middle of 2012, so to obviously win here is huge. It's been a while and...
To win it in style as well, that must be so much more satisfaction. Shooting 67 to close and 19 under, runaway win.
Definitely, yeah. It was really nice to have a little bit of a buffer coming up the last day. Could enjoy it a little bit. And
I think this is your ninth victory, a couple in the United States, five or so in Australia, Korea as well. But
yep.
I take it, given the ranking points, the money, the prestige of this tournament, this has to be the foremost one.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, the win on the PGA Tour was exciting. And to be out even playing golf is pretty awesome. And obviously, to be, you know, down there collecting a trophy, you've really got to savour that. It's not very often you get to hold up the trophy in front of a crowd. And I definitely really enjoy that. And yeah, definitely something I want to do more often.
I dare say the money comes in very nicely, but there's ranking points, there's doors opening. I don't know if you've considered a European Tour future.
Yeah, well, she brought that up in the scorer's tent, one of the officials. So I'm not sure what I'm going to do yet. I really don't know. I'll have to sit down and think about it. I've got a young family and...
That was Australian Mark Leishman, the 2015 Nedbank Golf Challenge winner, speaking in Sun City, South Africa. Turning to volleyball, Rwanda carried the day at the Castle Light International Beach Volleyball Championship in Entebbe, some 32 kilometers south of the Ugandan capital Kampala on Sunday. Rwanda's Flavian Ndamukunda and Pierre Marshall Kwizera outplayed Ugandan defending champions Emmanuel Kato and Nicolas Deyogera 21-18, 21-10 in the men's final. Another Rwanda team of Olivier Ntangengwa and Patrick Akumuntu claimed the bronze medal. In the women's final, Rwanda's Daisy Nzayisenga and Charlotte Mutasimpundu beat Ugandan defending champions Christine Alupo and Peace Businje in sets of 24-22 and 21-14. Kenyans Gaudencia Makoha and Naomi To were bronze medalists. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. An official in southern Somalia says authorities have captured an American who was a member of the militant group Al-Shabaab. Hussein Mohamed Barre tells VOA Somali service the man surrendered to officials and African Union troops in the coastal town of Barare in Somalia's Lower Shabelle region. Town District Commissioner Barre did not disclose the man's name, but said he declared himself to be a U.S. citizen. Barre said the man apparently escaped an assassination attempt by fellow Al-Shabaab fighters after a fight between two factions of the group. And the U.S. military says Monday that recent airstrikes have killed two militant leaders in Africa. Pentagon spokesman Captain Jeff Davis said a December 2 airstrike in Somalia killed Abdirahman Sanderi, a senior leader of the militant group Al-Shabaab, and two of his associates. The Pentagon also said the U.S. has confirmed that an airstrike last month killed Abu Nibel. That's it for this Tuesday, December 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clouty and Ricky Stryak, and our sports editor Mark Ouma, I'm James Batty in Washington saying have a lovely day.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, democracy wins with a smooth transition of power in Burkina Faso. President-elect Roch Marc Christian Kabore soundly defeated the opposition in the first free and competitive vote since independence. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss Burkina Faso's future under the new leadership of Kabore. Burkina Faso's future.